ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. Welcome everyone to ISKCON of Silicon Valley. We are continuing our perpetual Krishna Katha, as mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. It's great service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and to ourselves and anyone nearby to continue speaking about Krishna and repeating Krishna's names in all times, in all places, in all circumstances. The Bhagavatam says, Yat Syat Sarvata Sarvada. That means that devotional service is good for all times and all places and all circumstances. There's no time at which one say it's not appropriate. And furthermore, the Srimad Bhagavatam says that for all kinds of people, for the yogis, for those who are desiring liberation, for those who have no material desires whatsoever, even for the materialistic person, is advised to take to the process of devotional service, starting especially with the process of hearing and chanting. I bring this up so that we feel fully authorized to do what we're doing here today. If anybody felt guilty about taking time off from, you know, doing any other kinds of activities, coming from afar, the energy that you expended to get here and so forth, you might think, well, you know, was it worth it? So I'm saying, according to the scriptures, according to the great authorities, the acharyas, it's altogether worth it. In fact, we find that great personalities that we hear about in the histories of the shastras go to great lengths to meet together. What are some of the places that great sages have met together just to talk about Krishna that you can think of? Where? Naimasaranya. That's the place where no one sleeps. Naimasaranya. That's what it means. There's no blinking there of the eyes. Not even for a blink of the eye do they stop talking about Krishna in Naimasaranya. Where else does the topic go on perpetually? Well, it was also at the bank of the Ganges when Parikshit Maharaj he accepted a curse that was given to him by a little boy, and he went to the Ganges and he sat down, and many kinds of people came there. There were karmis, gyanis, yogis, and finally we found Shukadeva Goswami came there, and everyone dedicated their time simply to sitting, listening to the talk of Shukadeva Goswami and Parikshit Maharaj. And in fact, at the outset, Shukadeva Goswami mentions that three kinds of people get benefit when this kind of talk goes on. That is, those who are doing the speaking, those who are doing the listening, and everybody else in between who happens to hear it. Even if it's incidental hearing, that is, we noticed our very own Victoria, Bhaktin Victoria, who comes here regularly, was walking down the street in Palo Alto, minding her own business, and she happened to hear the katha coming from our mini festival at Palo Alto on University Avenue, and it caught her attention, and she said, "That sounds like a good idea." All the pieces came together, and she came and gave her full energy to the process of Krishna consciousness. So it's important to give ourselves full authorization. Not that we give ourselves full authorization, but we understand that we're authorized, and that we give ourselves permission to fully absorb ourselves in hearing and chanting, especially when it's at hand. There are times during the day which we have better opportunities than at other times. For instance, early in the morning, I've noticed, and taking time to hear and chant that very early in the morning, people are less likely to call. Of course, they can call from different time zones, so it's a good idea to turn off your phone anyway these days, right? But generally, people are in a different kind of mood in the morning, not as interactive, and there's not so many people out and about. And the mind may protest and say, you know, shouldn't we be doing something else? But fortifying oneself by understanding that I can give my full energy, my full attention to this activity, and I'm justified in doing so, is a good way to pay attention and stay focused. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in one of his poems, that there's nothing else to be had in the 14 worlds except for the holy name. That's a pretty broad statement, but it's one that can help to focus the mind, because when the mind says, how about if I go somewhere else, rather than sit here for the holy name and be present for the holy name, then we can remind our mind, nam bina kichu nahiko or choda bhuvanamaje. There's nothing else to be had anywhere else. Doesn't matter where you go, you won't find what you're looking for. On the other hand, this process that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given is called by Karabhajana Muni abhishta doham. That is, it actually fulfills the inner desire of the soul. It's what everyone's actually been looking for. It's what I'm searching for in all the wrong places, and I'm not getting, but I can find it in one place. And this is one of the messages in the Bhagavad Gita, is to be a specialist. Focus your attention on devotional service. One verse that comes to mind, Vyavasayatmika Buddhir Ekeha Kuru Nandana. Krishna says in the Gita that your mind should be fully fixed on one thing, and that is thinking of your service to Krishna. Elsewhere, Krishna says, Manmana Bhavamat Bhakto. Just think of me. Another place in the Bhagavatam, the demigods speaking to Krishna within the womb mention that just by focusing the mind fully on Krishna, one satisfies all the other needs of life. So this is called shraddha, actually, or faith. This growing sentiment and determination that by focusing on this one thing, everything else will be nourished in my life properly. Like watering the root of a tree. If you water the root of the tree, all the leaves and branches are automatically satisfied. So the statement in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Shraddha Shabde Vishvas Kahe Sudhridna Nischoy Krishne Bhakti Koila Sarva Karma Krita Hoy, and that is that this faith means that a person has well-reasoned faith, has well-reasoned determination to perform devotional service, knowing that by doing so, all other things are performed. And Prabhupada mentions it in a poetical way in one of his purports, that it synchronizes all the other energies of the universe just by focusing on chanting the holy name of the Lord. Everything else becomes channelized and synchronized through that. So this Maha Mantra is a primary sadhana, it's a practice. And I was thinking recently about how important it is to have a clear idea that it is the primary sadhana, because when one's practicing something, one has to take it seriously. If I do it half-heartedly or I don't do it with full attention, there can be consequences. For instance, I can develop bad habits while I'm doing it. As an example, if somebody's learning to play a musical instrument and they're not precise in how they're playing scales or how they're placing their fingers on the instrument and so forth, and then they continue to practice that imprecise method, later on they'll also have problems. But if one starts very precisely with a musical instrument or any kind of a physical discipline, then gradually, as one develops mind-muscle connection and practices muscle and gets muscle memory, one becomes proficient even at higher speed and can take on more. So you have to start in the right way. And people perform many kinds of sadhana in this world. I was thinking of sadhana or practice in a different way. You, of course, everyone's heard this word sadhana, right? It means practice. And then there's sadhya, which means the goal of the practice. So why would somebody be practicing something? They have a goal in mind. And recently I was listening to Gopi Puranadana Prabhu, and he was talking about how people do all kinds of sadhanas in this world. For instance, yesterday I was walking with my friend Thomas through the Washington Park, and we saw a man practicing playing basketball. And he was throwing the ball up against the backboard again and again, not at the hoop, but he was just practicing, you know, because you have to get that coordination. Some people bounce two balls at the same time, and they go up and down the court until they get coordinated on that. It takes a lot of work to do that. The goal would be to be able to maneuver the ball up and down the court in between defenders and so forth, and to have good control of it. That's a kind of sadhana. Are there other kinds of sadhana you see people practicing around the world? What? Facebook sadhana? Checking Facebook. I don't know if that comes under the category of sadhana. I mean, it may be, maybe there's another category where things are not well thought out. You're not really disciplined. You're actually just doing it because it's a default mode. The mind doesn't want to be disciplined, therefore there may be activities. And I think Facebook might be one of them, because there's a lot of random images on Facebook, and somehow that's attractive to the mind. Because I've watched kids look at random images, and they go into a glazed look, and I think adults are like that too. But I'm thinking of, you know, it's like conscious control over your lifestyle. That's what discipline means. And conscious control over your lifestyle for what? What are some of the other ways people actually consciously control themselves in order to come to a result? Kanka? Because she doesn't have a microphone, let the record show that she said athletes.
They become really regulated in their life, and they practice.
Like what? Well, tell one kind of athlete.
Okay, like if you're a competitive swimmer, you're going to get up early every morning at like 5 in the morning, and you're going to practice for 2 or 3 hours. And then in the evening, you're going to practice again for 2 or 3 hours.
What about javelin?
Javelin? I'm not familiar with javelin, but I know...
It's a spear.
I know there's a lot of athletes.
In track and field, it's a spear, and you can practice throwing over. There's not it's not one of the most popular sports in the world. And then there's the shot put, which is a big ball. And there's a sadhana for that. I learned when you're learning to play madanga, there's different kinds of sadhana. Like there's finger practice, there's hand practice, there's sadhana that's more for playing like tabla-like beats on the madanga. And you specifically concentrate on a particular kind of practice to get a certain kind of sadhya or goal, to reach a certain goal. And people have different ideas about what kind of sadhana to practice around the world. But one thing's for sure, as Prabhupada mentions in a lecture, that with knowledge and practice, one can advance in almost every discipline. You have to have these two things, knowledge and practice. So one of the topics for tonight, or the main topic, that I committed to, although I hate to do that, because then I'm trapped. But because Vishakha Leela asked me to give her a title back on Monday, and I don't think I gave it until Tuesday or Wednesday morning. But tonight, this came into my mind about taking conscious control of your lifestyle. Taking conscious control of your lifestyle. And that sentence is derived from the word discipline, because that's the very definition of discipline in the dictionary, to take conscious control of your lifestyle. And just unpacking it from the word discipline, which sometimes can have, I don't know, it has negative and positive connotations, perhaps. He was a disciplinarian. How does that make you feel? Someone might say, ooh, that reminds me of such and such, who was a little too conservative with me and not, and maybe liberal with himself. Many images might come up. But the word discipline itself, when we unpack it and we think about the common sense of taking conscious control of your lifestyle and what the implications are, I think it could be useful. What do you think? Any thoughts about the title? Just to reflect? Yes, Thomas. Just make sure that the microphones are flowing because all our friends are online and they can't hear a word without it.
Conscious control, how important that is, that there has to be active, alert engagement. You'll never gain any kind of control over your lifestyle without a determined, conscious apprehension of where you are.
What's the difference between that and, what's the opposite of that?
A default, or just going through the motions, or putting yourself on cruise control or autopilot in your spiritual life. Yeah.
Cruise control, autopilot in your spiritual life. There's a term for it in the scripture, isn't it? This is actually mentioned in one of the most important books about how to practice devotional service called The Nectar of Instruction, otherwise known as Upadesha Amrita. So Upadesh means advice, and Amrita means nectar. So it's kind of nice, the nectar of all advice. And in that book, he talks about this principle you're bringing up, Thomas, about unconsciously practicing. That is, there's a way in which the mind, which is the main sense, it's the sense which is called the sense within, and it's also called the leader of all the other senses. There's a possibility for my external senses to be engaged, but if they're not communicating or not synced with the mind, then I actually don't even have the experience. For instance, you can be anesthetized, if that's the right word, and your senses can be stimulated, but because your mind is no longer involved, you won't feel it, you won't experience it at all. Are there any other circumstances in which you can be not anesthetized and you can be doing something, but you're not aware that you're even doing it? What? Driving? Uh-oh. Yeah, driving. You can just be driving. And this happened to me when my mother was getting ready to pass away, and people said, or maybe she already passed away, and it was right afterwards, and they said, you know, you're a little more out of it than you know. And I said, I'm fine. And I started driving home, and I ended up going for a half an hour in the wrong direction. Then I realized, oh, I didn't even know where I am. My mind was somewhere else completely. That, by the way, is one of the reasons it says in Scripture that one shouldn't worship the deity after somebody in the family dies. There's a contamination period. Everyone says, what's that? It actually has to do with the fact that your mind isn't able to engage in deity worship at that time because you're pulled in another direction. And so you're not fully aware of what you're doing and so forth. Yes?
I was thinking one can be doing japa without being aware.
Uh-oh. That's possible. And that's partly what we're getting back to, is this conscious control of lifestyle, and very particularly for us, being very careful about being conscious, specifically for those very important kinds of activities that we do during the day. We get a small window of opportunity to do them, so why not take full advantage of them when we can? I'm thinking of another phenomenon, physical phenomenon, that which I can't remember the name, the terminology for this, but there's a way in which if there's an odor in the air and you're there long enough, after a while you don't even notice it. Like, for instance, if you live in Gilroy. Gilroy's the garlic capital of the world. It's just a little further down south. Our friends in Gilroy don't smell garlic, but if you drive there, You can immediately smell garlic everywhere. But there's a way in which the sense and the mind are no longer connected because it's overstimulated or something. I don't know the exact mechanics of it, but after a while you don't even notice it. That can happen with anything. Yes.
People in India, when they drive, they honk, or they just don't notice it.
They ask them to honk. It's on the back of every truck. It says, use dipper, sound horn. Lincoln, please don't. But yeah, so many horns. Everyone gets. So there's ways in which you could be reading a book. At least I'll say for myself. Sometimes I'm reading a book and my mind is churning about some situation that I need to deal with, right? And I can go down a whole paragraph and then I'll question myself. Say, okay, what did you just read? And I have no idea if someone just asked me what I just read. But I definitely read it. My eyes read it. The words went in. The impression was made on the retina. But the mind was somewhere else. Therefore, there was no register. I can't say what it was. My brother's a music teacher. I asked him once, I said, what's the peak learning experience? And he said, you have to be there for it. You actually have to register while you're practicing and things like that. Because I was asking, and what if you do it so many times, like in learning a chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, you can read it over and over and over and over again. After a while, after a long while, you might just start to remember it. But if you're more conscious while you're doing it, and you make mnemonic devices, and you connect to it and things like that, then perhaps because you're more conscious, because you're really noticing what you're doing and connecting it to other things, you'll learn more quickly. Does that sound reasonable? So that is all within the realm of this idea of consciousness and how it affects the way in which we practice things. And the phrase is that discipline means to take conscious control of your lifestyle. To take conscious control of your lifestyle. So, first of all, I'm going to read a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Because you can never go wrong doing that. And the first verse I'm going to read is from Bhagavad Gita 3:30. And we'll have it up on the screen in 5 seconds or less, or your money back from this Sunday Feast program. 3:30. 3.30. That was pretty close. Okay, so I'll say, please repeat. Let's hear the vibration of this verse. Mayi sarvadikarmani sanyas yadhyat machetasa nirashir nirmamo bhutva yudyasva vigata jvaraha. Let's look really carefully at the word for word and see the kind of benefit we can get from seeing what each word means. Mayi, mayi. Unto me. Sarvani, all sorts of. Karmani, activities. Sanyasya, completely giving up completely. Adhyatma, with full knowledge of the self. Chetasa, by consciousness. Okay, so that's like the first half of the verse. What impressions did you get from hearing that word for word, perhaps in relationship with the theme of the class so far? Unto me, all sorts of activities, giving up completely with full knowledge of the self by consciousness. Do you see any relationship between that and the topic? I hate to make you do all the work, but
yeah, it The word that really registers is by consciousness, chetasa. So we should be present.
Should be present, conscious. Okay? Thank you. Thanks for noticing that.
The other one that came to my mind was with full knowledge of the self, which means in relation to the title of the lecture was doing it deliberately. That is because for a reason. You're doing it with consciously, okay. Deliberately.
Okay, good. Anything else? Unto me all sorts of activities. Giving up all sorts of activities unto me with full knowledge of the self. Second part. Nirashi. Without desire for profit. Nirmamaha. Without ownership. Bhutva. So being. Yudyasva. Fight. Vigata jwaraha. Without being lethargic. There's a nice list there. Let's look at the translation. It's brought out in the list also. So I'll say, I'll read the whole thing first. Therefore, O Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me with full knowledge of me, without desires for profit, with no claims to proprietorship, and free from lethargy, fight. Now we'll say it all together. Therefore, O Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me with full knowledge of me, without desires for profit, with no claims for proprietorship, and free from lethargy, fight. And here's the purport. By His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. This verse clearly indicates the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita. That's a good start, isn't it? The Lord instructs that one has to become fully Krishna conscious to discharge duties as if in military discipline. Again, the Lord instructs that one has to become fully Krishna conscious to discharge duties as if in military discipline. Such an injunction may make things a little difficult. Nevertheless, duties must be carried out with dependence on Krishna, because that is the constitutional position of the living entity. The living entity cannot be happy independent of the cooperation of the Supreme Lord, because the eternal constitutional position of the living entity is to become subordinate to the desires of the Lord. Arjuna was therefore ordered by Sri Krishna to fight as if the Lord were his military commander. One has to sacrifice everything for the goodwill of the Supreme Lord and at the same time discharge prescribed duties without claiming proprietorship. Arjuna did not have to consider the order of the Lord. He had only to execute his order. The Supreme Lord is the soul of all souls. Therefore, one who depends solely and wholly on the Supreme Soul without personal consideration, or in other words, one who is fully Krishna conscious, is called adhyatma chetas. What does adhyatma chetas mean? One who is fully Krishna conscious? So again, in relationship to that term which comes out in the verse, the Supreme Lord is the soul of all souls. Therefore, one who depends solely and wholly on the Supreme Soul without personal consideration, or in other words, one who is fully Krishna conscious, is called adhyatma. It's like Prabhupada says, in other words, one who is fully Krishna conscious. So here's a definition of being fully Krishna conscious, and that is, seeing that the Lord is the soul of all souls, and that if you depend on Him completely and don't have any personal consideration, then you're connected. There's a section in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto in which Lord Brahma has given prayers to Krishna, and just afterwards Shukadeva Goswami is describing why devotees are so attracted to Krishna. It's especially in the context of Krishna expanding himself into the cowherd boys and cows. And actually, you know, I don't know which verse it is, but maybe jumping around a lot like that, I can see everyone's eyes are going to the screen, maybe too much. Shukadev Goswami mentions that the reason that the residents of Vrindavan became so attracted to the replicas of the cowherd boys and calves that Krishna made, that were actually expansions of his very self. They were non-different from Krishna. And previously, the boys and calves had gone off to the forest, Brahma had stolen them away, and Krishna reproduced them. Literally, they looked exactly the same, they had the exact same characteristics. And then all those duplicates went back to Vrindavan. And when they did, Balaram noticed something, and that was that all the parents of those children and the parents of the cows became infinitely more attracted and affectionate towards those expansions. They were apparently the same personalities, but they were Krishna. So Parikshit Maharaj wanted to know why, and Shukadev Goswami said that because Krishna is Atmanam Akilatmanam, which means that he's the soul of our soul. And so there's a thought experiment you can do about how it is that we're actually attracted to our own soul. What's important to us? I may say, my body's important, my family's important, my house is important. But all those are important to me only because of their relationship to me. For instance, as if we've done this thought experiment before here, where you parked your car outside, right? Dilip Bhai? And then we hear a fire engine come by and someone says, what kind of car do you have? What color? He doesn't even know, he's so detached. I picked the wrong person, he's a Navaduta. He doesn't know what kind of car he has. It's a white Toyota? A gray Toyota, he thinks. Okay, so we hear there's a gray Toyota on fire right on the corner, and then Dilip Bhai, well, a fake Dilip Bhai, another one, not him, he doesn't care. But here, a gray Toyota is on fire, the fire engine is there putting it out, and the fake Dilip Bhai will start perspiring, he'll run to the door. He'll get his wife on the phone halfway there and he say, oh my God, guess what happened? And then he gets out there and it turns out that it belongs to Ramananda Sakha. And then Dilip Bhai is like, oh, never mind. It's okay now. It's not a problem for me anymore. But it's the same car. He drives the same Toyota, actually. And it's all made out of the same kind of materials. And there's lots of Toyotas around the world that are burning right this second, believe it or not. A lot of Samsung telephones burning up too, I hear. There's a recall. Was it Samsung?
Yes.
Yeah, they spontaneously combust. But we're not concerned because they're not ours. And there's a way in which I transfer my own self into the things around me. And I say, oh, that's my car. And therefore, when somebody scratches it, I become concerned because I identify it with myself. It's an expansion of myself. That's why I say my car. I don't say a car. I say that's my car. And that's the difference between a car and my car is I've invested myself into it. And it's a way in which the soul can actually project itself into the matter around us. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Aparayamitastanyam prakritim vidime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayedam daryate jagat. That's what's animating the universe, is this consciousness of claiming everything to be mine, and therefore the soul's moving the material elements around, manipulating the material elements in an attempt to enjoy them. And the only way to enjoy them is to see them in relationship with oneself. And I do that with my body also. I'll say, this is my body. And the reason I say it's my body is what? Huh? Because I'm inside it. Once I leave the body, it's no longer my body. What is it then? It's worm food. As Prabhupada points out quite graphically, somebody, after you go outside your body, somebody can kick on your face and you won't mind. Of course, there is some residual, because then once you leave the body, even there's a sense that, that the soul was in that body, and therefore the body's even sacred. So there's care taken for the body. The body's even revered. You know, when they take a body away, people don't defile the body or anything like that. In civilized worlds, they do some ritual. Even as I noticed when people were driving down the road, if a squirrel was killed, he's already dead, flat on the road, people, like, I don't want to run over him again. Why? Now it's just matter, right? But there happened to be a soul inside it, therefore it's special. And everything becomes special with the touch of spirit inside. So the soul is what's important. And one can discern this through this thought experiment of reverse engineering and find out, why is something particularly important to me? It's only because I've invested myself. And then looking and seeing, what is myself? Now, one can experience how attached one gets to all the things that are mine. Anybody attach things to your mind? If not, let me know. We have a donation box right over here. Because we'll help you out. And see to what degree I'm attached to my money or whatever it is. But I get attached to all these things, and you can see for yourself how much I'm invested in my stuff. And then you can see that the self matters. And therefore Shukadeva Goswami then says, Atmanam Akhilatmanam. He says, the Krishna is the soul of your soul. Imagine how important the soul is to you, how it animates the body, and it's what I'm actually interested in. Because when the soul leaves the body, either my soul leaves the body or somebody else's soul leaves the body, then I'm no longer interested in that body. So the main point of interest is the soul in this world. And then if you consider, what is the soul of all souls, then the soul of my soul, how much I would be attracted to the soul of my soul. Atmanam akhilatmanam. So Krishna is the soul of all souls. Pardon me? Krishnam enam avehi tvam atmanam akhilatmanam jagat dita yaso pyatra dehi va bhati mayaya. And the translation goes like this. Drum roll, please. There it is. You should know Krishna to be the original soul of all living entities. For the benefit of the whole universe, he has, out of his causeless mercy, appeared as an ordinary human being. He has done this by the strength of his internal potency. So that's the section of the Bhagavatam that talks about how Krishna is the soul of all souls. And we'll go back to the verse in the Bhagavad Gita. And there we had noticed that the Supreme Soul is the soul of all souls. Therefore, one who depends solely and wholly on the Supreme Soul without personal consideration, or in other words, one who is fully Krishna conscious, is called Adhyatma Chetas. And it's interesting that Prabhupada mentions that without personal consideration. Because actually, as much as I invest in my own self-interest, if I consider that Krishna is the soul of all souls, if I'm investing in Krishna, then I'm making a very fundamental investment in myself. I'm not missing anything because he's the soul of all souls. So solely and wholly, one depends on the Supreme Soul without any personal consideration. And this is an attitude or a state of mind that one cultivates, according to this verse, as one is attentively practicing devotional service, depending solely and wholly on the Supreme Soul without personal consideration. It's actually a relief to do that, because the reciprocation is profound. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Ananyas chintayanto mam ye jana paryupasate tesham nityabdi yuktanam yogakshemam bahamyaham. And that is a similar kind of idea, ananya cheta, that just without any other consideration, I'm focusing my mind on Krishna, solely and wholly. Ananyas chintayanto mam, my chinta, my consciousness, is fully engaged in Krishna. In fact, Krishna is speaking this verse, and he says, ananyas chintayanto mam, he's saying, if you just fully absorb your consciousness in me, ye jana paryupasate, and in a worshipful state of mind, you're worshipping Krishna, tesham nityab yuktanam yogakshemam bahamyaham. He says, then, don't go there, I'm going to stay on this verse. I carry what you lack and I preserve what you have. Too late. Ananya, okay. Go back. So this is one point. Adhyatma Chetas. Everyone say please.
Adhyatma Chetas.
So this is one of the aspects of being fully absorbed as one is practicing, is this state of mind of depending solely and wholly on the Supreme Soul without consideration of one's personal gain, only thinking of investing in Krishna. And it's a concept that's counterintuitive to my materially trained mind. And as evidence, last night I had a conversation with a gentleman when we were down at the Harinam Festival in Palo Alto. And he had, you were there, you heard him, right? He was very much concerned with investing his consciousness in Krishna and then suddenly at some point realizing that he had given away all his energies and had spent so much time thinking of Krishna but then feeling lost, and that he had given up his own personal interest in the material world, but then because of trying to be enjoyed by Krishna and having Krishna be the supreme enjoyer, then he felt at some point one would realize that there was a lack in one's life and one might feel bereft. And there's a long conversation that can go with that, but that's definitely a fear. He was just kind of a philosophical person, but he had that definite hesitation, right? About any devotional path, because if I devote myself wholly and solely, as it's mentioned here, to somebody else, I might be disappointed. I think that was the essence of his point, right? So that's possible. The mind might think that, like, if I don't take care of myself, if I'm thinking of Krishna all the time, then I may be let down somehow. So this is something to be cultivated through studying one's actual relationship with Krishna and the nature of one's own self. One can develop what's called adhyatma chetas, chetas, adhyatma chetas. Can everyone say again?
Adhyatma chetas.
And in a summary, what would you say that means? What was Krishna's intention? Someone take the mic and explain it. When he mentioned this phrase in his verse.
One has to become fully Krishna conscious.
Which means what?
Adhyatma chetas.
What it means to be fully Krishna conscious, though? Huh? Anybody say?
One who depends wholly and solely on the Supreme Soul without personal consideration.
Yeah, I think that's an important concept, depending on somebody else, depending on Krishna. And there's another verse I'm going to read here, but I'm going to cheat and just read the translation of it really quickly, because Krishna again says later on in the 18th chapter, 59th verse, just the translation, if you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. a lot of assurances there from Krishna that if you just absorb your consciousness in me, wholly and solely, that I will support you. So the next phrase we're going to hear, which is continuing in the purport I was in, nirashi. Everyone say nirashi.
Nirashi.
Means that one has to act on the order of the master, but should not expect fruit of results. One should act on the order of the master, but should not expect fruit of results. And then now Prabhupada gives an example that everyone can probably relate to. The cashier may count millions of dollars for his employer, but he does not claim a cent for himself. Similarly, one has to realize that nothing in the world belongs to any individual person, but that everything belongs to the Supreme Lord. That is the real purport of Mayi, or unto me. And when one acts in such Krishna consciousness, certainly he does not claim proprietorship over anything. Reflections on just that section about not claiming proprietorship over anything? Yes.
Hare Krishna. So, to me, the beautiful meaning of that is if you extend the example a little bit further. Because you're a cashier counting the money for someone else, you don't get bothered whether you made a profit that day or a big loss, or even if there was nothing made today and there's a huge loss, while the proprietor gets affected by the resulting emotions.
Isn't that nice? Isn't that one of the nice things about being a servant of the master? Like, the king has to worry about all kinds of managerial problems, who's attacking the kingdom and so forth, but the servant just does whatever the king says and remains peaceful in that. Yes?
I think if you're invested in the cause of the person that you're serving, then you are bothered.
Yeah, it could be that also because, I mean, just, you know, if you're in a bank and you can notice that it's not making any profit, you can think, will I be employed here? But if you're out of love also, there's a connection. Out of love, the devotees do want to see that things go well. Can you rectify that? Can you bridge that?
Well, I think it's like Bhaktivinoda Thakur spoke about his anxieties, his greatest anxieties being his greatest ecstasies, but that requires a transition in consciousness.
So it's a different kind of attachment, and therefore it's a different kind of a result, the experience of being concerned whether the master's operation is going well or not, right? Yeah. Yes, Manjula Kanta?
I think the closest analogy for that would be like with a mother and a child. Because the Lord, when He loves us and He does for us and we do for Him, the relationship is meant to be without expectation. So when we go out to serve the Master in this case, we are very concerned that whatever we do is beneficial or the result is positive for the Master. But when we say with no material consideration, no personal consideration, I don't care what it is to me. So I'm not bothered what the effect or benefit or loss is to me. My concern is only with the task and the effect of the task to my master.
That helps. Any other point on that? Yes?
So it's very important, like, whom do we serve? You have to choose the right master. Otherwise, your whole effort will be bad. Like in the example of Bhishma Pitama, who was serving Duryodhan, it was not for good cause. Like, even though their service was 100% dedicated for Duryodhan, like, they gave up their life also. So,
yeah, so here we're specifically talking about orienting ourselves towards Krishna as the proprietor of everything. Yes?
Maharaj, I was also thinking that when you realize or when you accept that Krishna is the proprietor, and that you don't own it, then you're more careful with the things. Like, you know, it's more like you're borrowed. Like if you borrow something from somebody, you're very careful with that.
Yeah, I like that. That helps a lot too, because that sense of love, you're working with somebody else's property, and I've noticed that before. Someone leaves you in the care of something and goes off, so I'll be right back, and you're thinking, oh, what if something happens while they're gone? It was fine when I left. What'd you do? So that there is a sense of that. Yeah.
Forest and rivers. I mean, if we start looking at them as Krishna's property, we'll be doubly.
Look at what?
The forests and rivers before we dump anything into them. Mm-hmm. If we start looking at them as Krishna's property, then yeah. we'll be doubly careful about yeah. spoiling.
Hari Prasad?
I think this is also a little confusing because these things are put in our name. Whereas, in the analogy that Prabhupada gives, the money is not in the name of the cashier. But these things are actually assigned to us.
Which things?
Whatever possessions, whatever money, anything in this world that that becomes ours, it's temporary, but it's also used by us and we're responsible for it. So that creates a lot more complexity, no?
Yeah, but the spirit of it is that one does one's due diligence and understanding also that there are reversals within the material world that are beyond one's control. As long as you do your due diligence, you can't be held accountable. In fact, you know, there's a way in which in the law, in the eyes of the law, when you do your due diligence, if there's an accident, a mistake, then you're not punished severely. If you did everything that you could to make sure, for instance, that there were safety standards enacted and so forth. If there's an accident, then everyone knows there's going to be accidents. But if you were negligent, then you're really held accountable for it. But I'm just saying that in the course of our lives, there are going to be reversals, and the possessions that we have, we can't keep anyway. But if we do the best we can to take care of them in those circumstances, considering that we need them for Krishna's service, for instance, I'll finish the sentence, then that holds up to the definition of doing due diligence.
I think it just gets more confusing and easier to get attached when the thing seems like it's yours and it's put in your name and you're responsible for it. Then it just kind of creates this whole world around that. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think it makes sense to everybody because we're used to that, yeah. right? But I think the added element here is that there's an overarching sense, and we can cultivate that ultimately everything belongs to Krishna. And that shouldn't be used as an excuse to neglect things, as sometimes devotees made the mistake when they would neglect their service. They put salt in the charnamrita or something like that, or in the sweet rice, and then give it to Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada would grimace, and they'd say, oh, Krishna's mercy, or something like that. Prabhupada said, not Krishna's mercy, it's your stupidity, and it's your fault. You have to be careful. So you can't just write things off, because it just belongs to Krishna, it doesn't matter. But there is a way in which we understand that certain things are entrusted to me. So the verse in the Ishapanishad says, Ishavasam idam sarvam yat kincha jagatyam jagat tena tyaktena bunjita magridha kasyasuddhanam. Everything animate or inanimate within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things knowing well to whom they belong. Tena Tyaktena, there's a little loophole in there. It's not a loophole, but it's an interesting phrase that although everything's owned by the Lord, he sets aside certain things for every living entity. Everyone gets their own little realm. The birds have their, I just marvel at washing the living entities in my back garden and just seeing how Krishna has allotted to them certain kinds of fruits and flowers, and everyone has their little realm. It's like, okay, you can have this, and you take that over there, and everyone at Tena Tiaktena. He set it aside. And if I'm thinking like that, that everything belongs to Krishna, but he set aside this as my quota, and part of that quota means that you also have to be able to satisfy your senses to a certain degree. That is legal. But as the Shastra says, kamasya nendriya prithir labo jivete yavata jivasya tatva jignasya narto yash cheha karma bihi. Life's desire should never be directed towards gratifying the senses, but whatever is given to one should be utilized for preparing oneself to go back to Godhead, specifically towards inquiring about the Supreme. Kamasa nendriya prithir labo jivete yavata jivasya tattva jignasa means that you should live to inquire about the truth. That's a nice phrase, isn't it? You could make a bumper sticker like that. Jivasya tattva jignasa, live to inquire about the truth. Narto yashche karma bi means that there should be no other interest that you have. So whatever sense gratification you do get, whatever facility is set aside for you by Krishna, should be used for his ultimate purpose. And that is, you have some leeway to use those things properly in his service. And it's a nice balance, because ownership turns sand into gold. You notice when we manage a temple, that when it's a community project and it's a public place, it's a little harder to manage, because, you know, we've seen this in ISKCON over the years, that with vehicles especially. I mean, once I ran into, it's only Ms. Jai Pratakaswami at the airport in the LAX. I was just out there distributing books, and he was coming through. And there's a picture of us out there together. He wanted to buy a Bhagavad Gita interactive disc from me. And I said, Maharaj, your money's no good here in Los Angeles. Please take it. And then I walked him down, and he was getting into the van that the devotees were picking up on, and the door fell off. And Maharaj had already gotten in the passenger seat, and he didn't even look up, because he was he travels all over the world more than anybody, and it's like he's so used to getting picked up in ISKCON vehicles. The door fell off, and he just kept reading. Because it's notorious that, you know, if something it belongs to Krishna, then, I won't take care of it because it's Krishna's. But if something belongs to Krishna but he's set it aside as my quota, then I better take care of it. It's sort of there's a nuance there. So we have to study the science and see how it's my stuff, but it's my stuff for Krishna's satisfaction. And then, you know, we can get the nice balance in the two things. Is that good? Okay. So, but that concept is there. Nirashi, it doesn't belong to me. So this is something very valuable, Krishna said, that we can keep with us. And when one acts in such Krishna consciousness, certainly he does not claim proprietorship over anything. You were good there. We're coming back. Okay, so I have the manuscript here. This consciousness is called nirmama, or nothing is mine. Everyone say nirmama.
Nirmama.
What does it mean? How do you feel about that? Feel fine, right? In some circumstances. Okay, and if there is any reluctance to execute such a stern order, which is without consideration of so-called kinsmen in the bodily relationship, that reluctance should be thrown off. In this way, one may become vigata jwara, or without feverish mentality or lethargy. Everyone, according to his quality and position, has a particular type of work to discharge, and all such duties may be discharged in Krishna consciousness, as described above. That will lead one to the path of liberation. So those three concepts which Krishna mentions, or several concepts, surrendering all your works unto me, he says in the translation to 330, have full knowledge of me, don't have desire for profit, and claim no proprietorship and ultimately be free from lethargy in doing that. In other words, step up for this. Try to cultivate it. Don't be lazy about it. And if you do that, Prabhupada mentions at the last part of the purport, this will lead to the path of liberation. So the topic is, we're talking about taking a conscious control of lifestyle. So I brought that verse up because it particularly talked about discipline and how one should, as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, have a sense of even military kind of training in which everything has to be in its place, one should be regulated and so forth, and one should be accountable. In the military, there's a way in which the general, not the general, but a sergeant will come in, not that I know much about it, but I've seen war movies before. Sergeant comes in and inspects the barracks and goes through with a white glove. And if there's any kind of dust or anything like that, then you're in trouble. If your shoes aren't shined, you're in trouble. If your bed isn't... You were in the military, and you're shaking your head. You want to tell us more about it?
I was part of a National Cadet Corps in India, but after that I was in the police. Police department. I think you absolutely said right. When the sergeant or the senior officer comes in the morning, when you get up, you have to line up all your stuff in exact that order, your cup, plate, your, you know, whatever those sleeping sacks you have in. So if it is not, then you're severely punished. You have to make 100 rounds, you know, like run, or you have to work hard late hours, no rest or something like that. So
Detailed ways in which one should maintain one's things and one's lifestyle, and one has to be accountable. And Prabhupada, when he was traveling, which he did extensively, would stop in a new place, and he actually used military terminology when he was writing his letters. You'll notice this. He'll say at the top of the letter where he is, but do you know what he says? How he mentions the temple he's at? He used camp. So he'll say Camp New Jagannath Puri or Camp Malaysia. Wherever he is, he says camp. This is military language. We're in the camp, like the generals arrived and, you know, we're in the camp now and we're scheming and so forth. Not only that, Prabhupada had servants who talk about how they were to take care of him, and he had everything on his desk the same way wherever he went. And they would be tasked with putting it all, the picture goes here, the cup goes here, my pen goes here, the dictaphone goes here. Everything had to be in its place exactly. Not only that, Prabhupada was meticulous about keeping his personal effects safe. He would lock them up twice in a bag that was locked, and then he put it in the armoire and he would lock that. And very disciplined in taking care of all the things that Krishna had set aside for him to use in his service. So this kind of attention to detail in caring for one's personal things and keeping on schedule, that's another thing that the military is very careful about. That, you know, if you're going into a battle and the troops are supposed to meet in a certain place, certain time, you don't come half hour late and say, sorry, we got caught up watching a movie or something like that. You'll be punished. You know, you have to be careful about these things. So this kind of attention to detail is something that we notice in people who are in the sattvagun. Sometimes people think sattvagun means just freedom. I'll let everything fall wherever it falls and just leave it there. That's more natural. That's more akin to the mode of ignorance, not the mode of goodness. Yes.
Thank you for this analogy, actually, and I share your experience. I've been in the Air Force in the year 2000, and more importantly, when there are the drills, so that they wake up you in the middle of the night. So the point is that you should be, the discipline is needed because you should be ready any moment to go. So, and the best analogy I can find is that you need to be any moment to be ready to die. And all this exercise is made for that one moment when you will be called. And it's daily discipline that I don't have, but that day you should be ready. That's
first of all, let's recognize and appreciate the soldier in our midst here. Putting himself in the harm's way for the sake of others. And yes, the being ready at a moment's notice, this is part of military training, being drilled like that for these kind of circumstances. I noticed during the military buildup in the 1980s, I had a bird's eye view of a lot of the soldiers because I practically lived in airports, because my service was there in distributing books. I grew up in airports, basically. And during the 1980s, especially, there was a huge military buildup, and there were lots of recruits coming in on their way to military bases all over America. Most of them are in the South. And because of the Civil War, they ended up there, just so in case there was another uprising. The military would be there. But they would go in rather a rough state, and after the military training for some time, they would come out after being trained how to wake up early in the morning, how to obey rules and regulations and things like that. I must say they were very clean, respectful, shiny, mode of goodness and things like that, and very receptive to Krishna consciousness. Could notice the difference when people were had gone through some disciplinary training. And we notice it also when devotees have some special training, even in our ISKCON society. For instance, I always notice if a devotee comes from Pune, where Radhe Shyam Prabhu has set up a systematic way in which to train devotees, pretty much 99.9% of the time you can assume that they're well-trained, that they know everything they're supposed to know, etiquette, they know, you know, how to do what they're supposed to do in Krishna consciousness, because there's a training system there. So this kind of training in Krishna consciousness, kind of discipline, is very important. Okay. So the overarching message is that discipline is very valuable. And studying what it is and how to achieve it in relationship to one's practice of Krishna consciousness is extremely beneficial. Noticing what the consequences are of not being disciplined, and also studying the benefits of being disciplined, and also finding out ways in which to discipline oneself to advance in Krishna consciousness by adhering to the recommended processes of Krishna consciousness is a sure way to attain success. As mentioned throughout the Upadeshamrita, there are very specific ways in which Rupa Goswami says, follow these six things that will help you to advance and avoid other things. So being careful about these things and accepting discipline in one's life, there's great fruit in that. Krishna mentions in the Bhagavad Gita that the supreme transcendence is forever situated in acts of sacrifice. It's mentioned also that the austerity is the wealth of the brahmanas. And there are various austerities mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita by Krishna, the 17th chapter, that relate to speech, the body and the mind, and the body and the mind, so those three things. And by observing these kinds of disciplines, one can immediately notice that there's a fruit involved. And we see this even in secular life, that by the practice of keeping to the task and carefully following the system that's given to one, one gets advancement. For instance, in practicing an instrument or any other kind of a skill, one can notice that one's making advancement. And that kind of progress is very encouraging. So now I want to talk about a few... Is everyone convinced about the benefits of discipline, or more convinced than they were before? Do you want to say anything about it before I move on to practical techniques for helping to be more disciplined in one's life? Yes.
I just noticed at the end it looked like Prabhupada was making reference to getting rid of the modes of material nature when he speaks about the reluctance to give up bodily consideration. And he says that that there's a feverish mentality and there's a lethargy, which seem to correspond to passion and ignorance, and so that we have to kind of break through these modes, and the discipline and the giving up, the sense of bodily connection will help with that.
Yes. And I heard recently a talk by Gopi Pranadana Prabhu, who was saying that we shouldn't underestimate the power of those modes to crush us. Because if one is inattentive in one's practice of devotional service, there's a way in which we can be recaptured by the lower modes of material nature. And Maya is very powerful, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Daivahi Esha Gunamayi Mama Maya Duratyaya. It's very difficult to overcome. So it's wise to find out from the same person who spoke that verse what he recommends as a means to rise above that crushing feature of the modes of material nature that can bewilder us and actually set us back in serious ways. And that's a good case for being disciplined. In fact, the next verse, 331, Krishna says, Ye me matam idam nityam anutishanti manava, that if you just make this your creed in life, to follow what I've said. Let's see the translation. He said, those persons who execute their duties according to my injunctions and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive activities. So it's like disciplining oneself to take Krishna's instructions over my own whimsy is a kind of discipline that is extremely important. And it helps us to become liberated from the three modes of material nature. You were going to mention something?
Yes, Maharaj. In Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna says that one who has controlled the mind can be his most, he can be his friend or a foe. And by following discipline, one helps strengthen the mind or control the mind.
Yes. In fact, in the end of the third chapter, Krishna talks about how to overcome kama, which he said is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. Why did I do that? Oh, I wasn't thinking right. And there are severe consequences. But Krishna says you should regulate the senses. He said in the very beginning, regulate the senses. This is a kind of discipline. And this is one of the tips that he gives. It's a good clue to actually how to advance in spiritual life is to regulate the senses. In fact, senses thrive on regulation. If anyone's lived in an ashram or in a monastery situation, may have experienced the freedom one gets from being on a very tight schedule, because, and especially when it's connected to the practice of Krishna consciousness, means you do everything at the same time. I notice every year when I stay at Govardhan, it's a brahmacharya ashram, and there the meals happen all at the same time every day. Our readings take place at the same time every day. Mangal Arati is exactly the same time every day, and it ends exactly the same time every day. And the senses get accustomed to that. And then it frees the mind to think of Krishna more readily. And it's amazing how fast a month can go by when one is regulated like that. So it's one of the ways in which one can help to make the mind one's friend is by regulating the senses. Don't let them do whatever they want when they want, but keep them on a regular schedule. Any other general thoughts about discipline? Yes.
So I'm just still structuring my thoughts around it, but I think the discipline comes when you have a sense of purpose, and what actually the way you unpack, Prabhu, when we say Krishna is all-powerful, all-attractive, and I think the way you explain through the thought experiment that how one is attached to their own position, their own thoughts, and then think of soul of soul, and think of the power and the attraction that you can develop. And once you have that power and attraction developed, once you have rationalized that, once you have digested that, I think the sense of purpose is developed. And once that purpose is there, discipline is a byproduct of that. I think the way you structured it, this was really phenomenal.
Nice, nice point. I'm glad you said that, because it's the first thing on my list. And that is that talking about, you know, practical ways, very practical ways that we can implement certain kinds of discipline in our life or structure our lives in such a way that we can be disciplined. One thing is to write down your goals. Decide what you want and write it down. Because when it's very deliberately proclaimed, when I write it down myself and I say this is what I'm actually going for, then it is starting to manifest from a subtle level to a grosser level. And words matter. In fact, the whole creation starts by language. Everything in this world starts by language. The Lord speaks it. In fact, language exists before the creation. It's a product of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He has the language and He brings it out. And when He speaks, then things start to move. There's a devotee, a friend of mine, his father, I used to tell him that your word is your bond. I think about that a lot. Your word is your bond. Because when you speak something, it has consequences. And when Krishna speaks something, it becomes immediate reality. And our words matter too. What we say, the language we use, and how we define what our goals are, and if we put it in writing, begin to move us in that direction. Prabhupada, for instance, wrote the seven purposes of ISKCON. And so it was very clear like what he was aiming for. And that gave him the impetus and the direction to know what things to accept, what things to reject, very specifically. So writing down goals, in fact, some teachers recommend that you rewrite them regularly. If you write down your goals, try writing them every day. Because if you do, it reinforces the whimsical mind that wants to invent something new. And we notice this also that in any kind of a project, in fact, experts have noticed this. For instance, an author that I've read, Guy Kawasaki, who was one of the founders of Apple Corporation, talks about in his book called The Art of the Start, How to Start Up a New Company, for instance. He mentions this phrase, gives this phrase that I've thought about a lot, where he says that frame or be framed. In other words, unless you frame what your day is going to be like, someone else will frame it for you. Your mind will come up with some other idea and say, you know, why don't you just look at Facebook all day or something like that and have, you know, about 5 bags of potato chips or something. I mean, that's possible. The mind can come up with anything from any position unless you frame it first and say, no, this is what we do. This is how we... Then the unruly mind... will float off in any direction. So frame or be framed. And also, another book I read called The Purpose-Driven Church, which was written by Rick Warren, who's a pastor in Southern California. We visited his church. We weren't able to go in because it was Thanksgiving Day, I think. Or what was it?
Sunday.
No, it was a special Easter Sunday.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. It was, anyway, he wrote in his book, has a lot of experience of growing a congregation, that you have to reiterate to your congregation at least every 30 days what your mission is. And it's a biblical principle because it comes from the Bible, which there was a wall of Jericho. I don't know anything about it. Maybe you can help us out. But there was apparently some devotees building a wall for a specific purpose. Will you want to give us any elaboration on the wall of Jericho?
Were they building the wall and they had obstacles?
Yes.
So that's the rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem after the Jewish exile. They had to come back and rebuild those walls, rebuild the temple again. But there were all these shatans, where we get the word Satan from, opposers who were disrupting their effort and keeping them from building the wall and then discouraging them. And so they had to constantly be built up as persons for them to build the wall up.
Thank you very much. That helps put it in historical perspective. Sadhu, sadhu. Means well done. So he says this is a Jericho principle, he coins. And he says that in any project that you're doing, including your daily sadhana, you have to have positive reinforcement on a regular basis. And so he says, for instance, for a whole congregation of people who try to all move in the same direction like we are, to be very focused on this discipline of devotional service, that we have to be reminded and encouraged. What's the mission? Why are we doing this? This is our mission. We're going in this certain direction. And so on a community level, that's important. On an individual level, it's important also. I have to revisit my mission regularly. And somebody says, no, I have it clearly in mind. But then we find that there are many ways in which we can drift off. Have you ever heard the term mission creep? Mission creep happens all the time. Even in meetings, you can have a meeting with 5 or 7 people in a room, and you start talking about one thing, and then half an hour later, you realize we're talking about something else. Even when people argue, they forget what they're arguing about sometimes. This is a book I read called How to Win an Argument, and he said the main reason people lose arguments is because they forget what they're arguing about. because the mind just drifts off. So we have this daily discipline, and part of it is can be aided by remembering why I'm doing this and writing it down. Be very clear about your goals. For instance, one thing that's helped me in my sadhana is to always cover the basics every day. And I define what my own basics are. What I won't go below in my sadhana. For instance, a certain number of pages. I've mentioned this many times. How many pages a day will you commit to read in the Bhagavad Gita or the Srimad Bhagavatam without fail? I guess I can say, if you don't have that, it's very difficult to advance in devotional service at any reasonable pace. And so there's precedent for that. The Goswamis of Vrindavan, who are our exemplars, are mentioned by Srinivasacharya as Sankhyapurvakanamaganatibi Kalavasani Krito. It says they counted everything they did. All the chanting they did, all the singing, all the bowing down, they knew how many times they were going to do it every day. This Prabhupada calls numerical strength, because it gives one a defense against the mind that says, like, all right, that was enough for now, let's wait. Joshua Hewitt said, this famous musician, apparently from Russia, said that if I don't practice one day, I notice it. If I don't practice 2 days, my teacher notices it. If I don't practice 3 days, everybody notices it, especially my critics. And so, you know, it's a daily discipline. We have to write it down and take what is the basic minimum that I do every day without fail. That's very helpful to know what my goals are. A couple of quotes. When you miss a target, never in history has it been the target's fault. Another one, success is 99% luck. Ask any failure. So there's other things that you can write down. One thing is to write down what are your bad habits. We had a JAPA seminar recently in Washington, D.C. area, and the first thing I asked all the devotees to do was to record themselves chanting JAPA and then play it back. And a lot of devotees are like, oh my, I wasn't actually chanting the Hare Krishna mantra over the last 10 years. That can be disconcerting. What other bad habits do I have? And if I notice them, if I bring them to my awareness, I can do something about it. But if I just keep doing what I'm doing unconsciously, then there's nothing I can do. Yes?
So one thing about improving performance in any activity is to measure it. Because if you measure it, you get a standard or a baseline, and then you can improve upon.
Yes. There's a lot of sayings like that. What gets measured gets done. What gets measured gets improved. What gets measured gets improved. So this is one of the things that we do for discipline is we count very carefully. And it doesn't mean sometimes we think, oh, I can only count my rounds or what. You can count a lot of things. There's a lot of things that you can count. So don't feel fanatical about making goals and just think, oh, let me just let it go whatever way I want. I do meet people who say that. I just chant in my mind, and I don't know how many I do, but I'm chanting all day long. It's like, I doubt that. I really do. Because if you actually just try to chant 16 rounds with attention, you'll see that. Maybe it's a little harder than you think. I know for myself, I was asked to write a book, and I wrote that book in my mind. And I kept telling, I really did. I really had it clear. Like, I know what every chapter is. I know how it's going to be and the whole thing. And then my editor would call me, how are you doing? Great. I'm almost done. Can you send me something? Well, not really, because I haven't written it. But when I actually sat down and did the discipline and started writing, I thought, oh my God, this is really hard. I mean, I actually have to go over, I think it was Hemingway who said that I spend, here's how you write, he said, you sit in front of the page and bleed. And another author said, I spend half the day putting in a comma and the other half of the day taking the same comma out. And I spend a lot of my time writing my book, going to the library, checking out books on how to avoid procrastinating when writing. And one of them said, put glue in your seat so you can't stand up. You just have to stay there. Write down your ideas. Write down your bad habits. Write down your good habits. What have you already developed that's working for you? So my point is that if you keep things in writing, and Prabhupada did say to write every day, it really does help to clarify. I notice that people who write are more articulate because they've thought about things more carefully. And it's a record of how you're thinking. And if you go back and visit what you wrote a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago, you can follow the pattern. So I recommend this as part of the structure for discipline, is write things down. Another thing may sound kind of obvious, but it's important, is you have to have motivation. Somebody might have mentioned that. And Abe Lincoln, a quote I like from him, he said, always bear in mind that your own resolution to succeed is more important than any other one thing. Because where there's a will, there's a way. And if I can develop a strong desire, then I can find ways to get it done. Krishna bhakti ras bhavito mati krito yadi krito pirlabhyate. Let me start over. Krishna bhakti ras bhavito mati krite yadi krito pirlabhyate tata lolyam api mulyam ekalam janmakoti sukritir na labhyate. Rupa Goswami writes about the practice of devotional service, that the main feature that drives it is your intense desire to have it. You really do have to be motivated. So, having made that obvious point, how do you get that motivation? One, and I would say the most important point is good association. Association with people who are motivated. So at least get yourself there to where the people are motivated. As they used to say in a company I was in, if you're motivated, then people need you in the meeting. And if you're not motivated, you need to be in the meeting. So find out where the motivated people are and just try to get in the room with them. Try to be in the same environment that the motivated people are, and you'll notice that it'll rub off and you'll start to develop it. And another place that you can get that association without moving yourself across the planet very much is through literature. And literature is such a source of inspiration for people in all walks of life, but imagine the fact that we actually have the direct writings. For instance, here's product placement of Rupa Goswami in the Laga Bhagavatamrita, this new book that's come out from the BBT. It's actually a miracle that he sat in Terkadamba, this beautiful little forest in Vrindavan, and specifically wrote the tenets of devotional service, the science of Krishna consciousness in a clear way. And imagine now that we have them available. And you can just go to a quiet place and absorb yourself in these pages. And you'll notice that you're improved. Your enthusiasm is improved. Your desire to be disciplined will be improved. And that's, of course, why I recommend it also that we read every day. If you read a certain number of pages of Prabhupada's books, like because his books are the vibration of ISKCON. And if you hear that vibration every day, then your intentions will be well-placed and your intelligence will be clarified. So good association, and you'll develop motivation for devotional service amidst all the other distractions and the other varying ideas that may come into your purview in life. If you keep strong in hearing Bhagavad Gita, for instance, you'll have a very clear idea about which way you should be going and a desire to discipline yourself so you can go that way. One sort of mental technique that I like to use to become motivated and stay disciplined is the law of forced efficiency. And that is, have you ever noticed that you get more done on the last day before you go on a long trip? Or is it just me? I remember all the things that all the people I should have called back, all the people I should have written to, all the projects that are sitting there, and if I don't do them, and it all comes down to the last week. And then what to speak of the last day, then it becomes urgent. What to speak of the fact if you're flying somewhere and the cab picks you up at a certain time. This is our situation because we live 7.5 minutes from the airport. And when we have a flight, I always think of it like death. Because, I mean, there's no getting around it. If you're going on a car trip, you go, so yeah, let's leave 15 minutes later. But when you're leaving, when the flight's leaving at 7 a.m. in the morning, the cab's coming at 5:30 a.m., You gotta be up there and be ready to jump in and go. And you gotta think what to take with you and finish your business and get going. And there you're in a highly motivated state. So considering this principle, you can impose it upon your mind artificially and say that this is the last day before I'm going on a long journey, or maybe this is my last day, period. Although that's a little hard to confront, isn't it? Sometimes. But if you think about deadlines and how much can I get done today and what are the most important things to do, that helps in being disciplined and not just thinking I'll do it tomorrow or something like that. Just a corollary thought to that concept is just that We have pressure in life. Yes or yes? Thank you. And we can choose between self-imposed pressure and pressure that comes from on its own accord. And if we discipline ourselves, then it's self-imposed. We get to choose what kind of pressure we'd like to have. Not entirely, but a lot more than if you just leave it to chance, because the pressure will come. So it's a lot better strategy to decide what kind of pressure you want to put on yourself and be disciplined yourself. Do it voluntarily, rather than let it come from another direction and then have to deal with it. And now we'll take a few reflections, anything that you heard so far that stuck in your mind. And Shraddha has one that came in online. Pardon me? Okay. If it's a good question, I'll have a look. Yeah. Good question. Okay, go ahead.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Today's class was like amazing. I think all points were very good. But I think I have to say only one point, so maybe I'll just... say what?
Be disciplined about it.
So what stuck to me is, of course, conscious control of our lifestyle, which is discipline, and we should do it voluntarily. Again, that's discipline. Otherwise, we'll be subjected to fate, and that we won't like it. So better to discipline ourselves voluntarily. So that's...
I like that. It was a nice summary. That really helped. Yeah, and I think it's one of the great treasures of being a human is that you can actually decide that you want to do this. I mean, that is the real gift of the human life. Jivasya tattva jignasya. You can live to inquire, and you can snip away at all the other distractions. You can actually do it. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, krame krame, step by step, just do this, and you can come to the highest position. And given the fact that we have perfect direction, we accept this. We say we have perfect direction. We're getting information from God Himself, and He's the perfect source of knowledge and direction. And if I can do my part and just discipline myself to follow what He says, it's so encouraging also that He says that even if you can't do the discipline completely, if you're trying to do the discipline, then I'm going to help you out. I'm going to shine within your heart, and I'll make all kinds of facilities so that you can come up to this point. And it's altogether doable. That is very encouraging about discipline. Why not, right? Thank you. That was very nice. Do we have a question that came in online? Okay.
So one reflection from Bhakta Prabhash from Chicago.
Oh, Bhakta Prabhash, Hare Krishna.
So he liked the phrase, frame or be framed.
Mm.
And the question is from Naveen Gupta Prabhu from Novato. Hare Krishna, thanks for class and a nice discourse. The question is that how do we distinguish passion and motivation?
Passion and motivation. Well, I don't know if they're completely parallel terms to compare and contrast, but... first of all, give me the definition of motivation. We'll go to the dictionary first. Then I'll call a friend after.
Motivation is the act or process of giving someone a reason for doing something.
The act or process. Say it again.
The act or process of giving someone.
Act of or process?
The act or process.
Or process. The act or process.
Or process of giving someone a reason for doing something.
The act or process for giving something somebody a reason for doing something.
The motivation.
Okay, the act or process. That's nice, isn't it? The act or process to give somebody a reason. That's what we've been talking about.
The condition of being eager to act or work.
Condition of being eager to act or work.
A force or influence that causes someone to do something.
Okay. Where does it come from?
I'm just...
Guess where it comes from before she gets there. What language? Latin. That's a high percentage bet. I say from Tamil. Oh no. This is a disaster. Okay, an actor process, giving somebody a reason to do something. In general, if the reason that we're acting is well guided, then we would say it's well motivated. I mean, there can be ill motivation as well, and that's what you're getting at in trying to compare these things. Passion can be an unbridled way of acting so that there's no real direction. So a real point here is that whether it's passion or it's motivation, however you consider these two terms, if they're guided properly, they're good. There is such a thing as spiritual ambition. We want spiritual ambition. It's not that we're considering a point where we become Shanti and we don't want anything. Devotees want Krishna. They want more service. They want to be with other devotees and things like that. And these kinds of ambitions, even including helping spread the Sankirtan movement, to be ambitious, just like an entrepreneur is ambitious. We have spiritual entrepreneurialism, which is well-reasoned, well-directed kind of ambition. So whether it's, we call it passion or whether we call it motivation, the main point is how that's being guided. If the passion is being guided for Krishna, this is a kind of a very powerful force. What else do we have, Shraddha, on that word?
I looked up motive, the word motive,
yes,
and the origin for that. So it comes from the Middle English, from Anglo-French, motive, or motive, from motif as an adjective, which means moving, and from the medieval Latin motivus, or from the Latin motus, which is the past participle of movere, to move.
To move.
Yeah.
Okay, what moves us? You don't move without motivation. Okay, you want to give us passion?
And passion is a strong feeling of enthusiasm or excitement for something or about doing something. It is also a strong feeling such as anger that causes you to act in a dangerous way.
Okay. Ratsanath Prabhu, you want to give any extra on the answer I gave about passion and motivation? Did it work for you, or is there something else you'd like to add?
I was trying to understand the intention of the question itself, and the way I understood it was the motor passion, and so sometimes motivation can appear like the motor passion, and I was trying to distinguish that you can have a deep motivation, but motor passion is how you pursue the motivation. So it can be done from a place of impatience, without fully thinking through things, and an enthusiasm that's not grounded. Or it can come from a place that's long-term, step-by-step, intentional. And I think both are fueled by motivation, but its pursuit is what makes all the difference.
Thank you, that helped a lot, because it was more precise, and there are descriptions in the Bhagavatam, for instance, of devotional service performed in the mode of ignorance, in the mode of passion, in the mode of goodness, and that which is transcendental. And despite the fact that I'm engaged in the process of devotional service, I will experience the effects of the modes of material nature in various ways. So being aware of what kind of motivation I have, even when it's for devotional service, can be helpful. Right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes.
Since I had the mic, I just took the privilege. So when you were speaking about discipline, I was thinking about the discomfort that the word creates.
Hold that just a little closer.
Sure.
Thanks.
And I recognize that discipline is confronting because it also brings up things that you don't like. Even in the process of devotional service, as much as chanting is emphasized, the mind doesn't like it. So that's one. And the other thing is, it's not glamorous. We don't like processes. We like goals. And if we were to get to a goal without having to go through the process, that would be great. But I think discipline is a process. So my question is, how do you prevent yourself from getting jaded? Because discipline requires a certain intensity and sharpness.
By the way, the word jaded, some people think it relates to a stone, but it actually relates to a horse. An old horse who's been run too many times around a track is called a jade. That's what they call an old worn-out horse, is called a jade. And so when we say we're jaded, you can think of an old horse who's run too many races and now is all worn out, doesn't want to do. So your question is, how do we prevent from becoming jaded in the process of our daily sadhana, for instance?
Yeah, because I think discipline requires your edge to be sharp.
Well, one thing is that you have to get a result. And you have to take it on. Although we say it all comes from grace and it's descending and everything like that, I have to position myself in such a way that I'll get that result. For instance, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that you have to beg for the holy name. So if I chant but I don't beg, I won't perhaps get an inspiration from my chanting. And there's a way in which, in Rupa Goswami's admonition that you shouldn't perform devotional service for no result. Niyamagraha means you're doing it, but you're not getting any result. Why would he mention it if it's not up to you to try to get the result? So you actually have to try for it, and it's illegal not to get it. Therefore, you have to organize your life in such a way that you get inspired. That's your job, and you can't blame it on someone else. You can't blame it on your mind or your intelligence or anything else. You have to blame yourself because you didn't try hard enough to get the result. So one of the ways in which one advances in devotional service is by getting inspiration. And so you have to really try for that inspiration on a regular basis, and you have to get it every day. The day I don't get an inspiration for my chanting is the day that I break the chain, and the next day my mind will say, well, there's nothing there. Why are you going to try? So you have to try to get it every day. And therefore, Rupa Goswami says, Tannama Rupa Charitaru Sukirtananu Smrityo Kramena Rasana Manasi Niyoja Tishnan Raje Tananuragi Jananugami Kalam Nayed Akilamiti Padesha Saram. This is the essence of all advice, and it's in the book that says it's the essence of all advice. And that is that you should organize your life around the principle of hearing and chanting so that you can get that inspiration. So take responsibility for your own inspiration. And if you can get one molecule, actually, you can change your entire life in one session of hearing a chapter of Bhagavad Gita. You can change your entire devotional career and outlook by one good japa session. You'll never be the same. One mantra. You don't have to wait, 50 years or whatever. You can do it now. And that attitude that it's fully available, I'm just not taking it, and taking the responsibility on myself is important in getting inspirational sadhana. And I appreciated your point, too, about discipline, bringing it up in a Sunday class, kind of like... you know, just the word itself, being disciplined and stuff. But I think developing a taste for it and looking, you know, taking that word out, looking at it in a different light and saying, wow, this is my friend. I see that's what Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita. It's like discipline is your friend. You regulate the senses, you're going to be happy, you're going to shine forth and so forth. Developing a new relationship with discipline. That's the name of my new book. And it's, you know, like that, it just thinking of it in a new way, it can be really inspiring, because then one can realize, well, I'm a human. I can actually do something about this. One becomes more jaded when one feels like, I can't do anything about this. But realizing that you can change it at any given time really helps. And then taking advantage of the free spaces that we have on the board, just like, what is that game, tic-tac-toe, or is it bingo or something? I don't know. There's a free space. Bingo? Okay. I haven't played recently. But there's a free space. There are free spaces in devotional service, like an hour and a half approximately before sunrise. Free space. It's like sitting there on the board. It's like, here's your free space. You get free inspiration at this time. If you just hang around that time, even, you know, people who are not interested in the devotional path, they write books about this thing. Where, like, just be there for it. Did you notice the sun is rising? Did you know it's the biggest event of the day? And it's like, meh. But if you're there for these specific things, you'll just get inspiration. They're available to us. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about it in his song, where he's mentioning all the devotional practices that give birth to bhakti. And what is that giving birth? I mean, it wasn't there yesterday, and all of a sudden it just shows up. And he says, here are the ways that you get it. You go to the holy places, like a lot of us have been going the last few years to Mayapur, and then we go to Srivasangam. And we can't stop thinking about what happened there the first time we went. We went there, and it's just a tiny little courtyard, and we're all thinking, I mean, when you're on pilgrimage, you can be thinking, like, what's really going to happen? Is this really a holy place? And then you start chanting Hare Krishna, and something happens that's inexplicable. There's some kind of taste. We will never forget that. That when we chanted there that first day, and all the devotees were looking at each other and thinking, what just happened? That's the stuff of inspiration. But you have to be there for it. So find out where the free spaces are in devotional service and be there for them and get your free nectar. It's floating through the air at that time. And if Macy's puts a sale for 95% off, don't go there the next day. Because then you go like, where is everybody? What happened to the thing? No, you have to pay now. Don't miss it. Yes.
Maharaj, I like your minimum program, which you said minimum standard, which you need to have each day. That is the best part.
That gives me a lot of solace from becoming morose, because you think, you know, the mind has a tendency to float this way and that way and become morose, but you think, I have my bare minimum that I stand on, my basics.
Maharaj, in India, typically there is a single party never comes to the power, so it's a coalition government. So in coalition government, what they typically say, minimum common program they derive out of their own agendas. So when mind has different agendas, let me do this thing, but minimum they stick to that standards. So I think I was correlating with that. That works,
nice.
Actually. So,
yeah, it does.
Thank you.
Yeah, it does. And it helps you go through the times when you may feel really distracted too. Your discipline of sticking to your basics, it helps your self-esteem, because there's a tendency to become discouraged in devotional service, think I'm not doing enough, I'll never be able to do enough. But if you stick to your basics, no matter what else happens, then you'll start developing a good reputation with yourself. And you get what's called spiritual self-esteem. Last point, yeah? Yes. He's in the back. Pass him a mic.
So, from my own personal experience, I would like to mention one thing is, for discipline, I think that sometimes we have this instantaneous discipline of, you know, helplessness. having that helpless, appreciating that helpless situation often helps us in focusing on the Supreme in that instant. Now, bringing that discipline throughout the life, day after day, is to, in Bhagavad Gita, the way they are explaining the living entity's helpless situation, the Supreme is controlling everything, we are not really in control of things. Appreciating that helpless situation day after day will help us in focusing on the discipline.
That's an excellent point. We were talking about that at lunch today, or brunch, or whatever it was. It was nice. Is this being akinchana? I don't have anything. Don't start with a mindset that I'm something, I'm already somewhere. Your discipline and your daily practice should start with emptying yourself out. Start over again, I'm a beginner. Start from there. And another thing I thought of while you were saying that was that it helps to be chastised. If you have somebody who can really get on your case and really blast you, it can really sober you up. It's like getting a slap in the face and you go, okay, I'm going to be good now. Because if the right person really like admonishes you, and that's why it's said that, you know, getting that from sadhus, you should have some sadhu in your life who can really lay into you and say, you know, you did that wrong, now pick it up and do it right. And it knocks some sense into you. Like once I was running for Mangalartik at the palace, the monastery we stay at, and I had a vow not to be even a second late, so I was running so fast in the dark, and I hit my head on the thing, and I went flying backwards. And I actually felt good about it, because not that I'm a masochist or something like that, but I thought, I really deserve that. I kind of like knocked some sense into me, like, you know, now I realize that, you know, at any minute I can be crushed and things like that. So chastisement helps too. And thank you very much for coming all the way here to ISKCON of Silicon Valley. And let's give one big Hare Krishna to everyone joined us on the internet today. Everyone, one, two, three. Thank you very much.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki. Nacharyar Marman. Hey, Nacharyar Marman.